Welcome to Industry Insights, the EFM podcast presented by the European Film Market of the Berlinale. Industry Insights puts a spotlight on highly topical and trend-setting industry issues, creating a compass for the forthcoming year ahead and beyond. This year-round podcast is produced in cooperation with the Goethe Institute and co-funded by Creative Europe Media. My name is Wendy Mitchell. I'm a film journalist, a festival consultant who is delighted to be your host today on a very important topic. We're looking at international film sales, current trends, and global perspectives. Today's episode was developed in partnership with Europa International, the professional organization that brings together a network of dozens of international sales companies, so thanks to them. I hope this episode we're going to look at what's happening now in the world of independent film sales, and also look ahead to how the whole industry can work smarter regarding sales in the future. We thought it was such an important topic to address post-pandemic, in the recovery. And it can be just a confusing area for people who are new to the industry. You know, is international sales the same thing as international distribution? Even the terminology can be a bit confusing. So we hope to demystify some of that and really take a snapshot of what's happening in the industry now. I'm thrilled that we are joined by three experts. We have Alice Lessor, who is head of international sales at Les Films du Lesange in Paris. She's also co-president of Europa International. Films du Lesange also has a distribution arm and does its own productions, and some of their recent sales titles include the animation Titina, One Fine Morning, and A Silence. We are next welcoming Katarzyna Cinaorska, who is head of sales at New Europe Film Sales in Poland, and she's also co-president of Europa International. A shared job with Alice there. New Europe does a lot of what we consider good old-fashioned film sales. They also have done some productions through a sister outfit. Recent titles they have sold have been really big hits, like Housekeeping for Beginners, Godland, and The Peasants, and I'm looking forward to them launching Ula Salim's Eternal in Rotterdam. Jean-Christophe Lamontagne is from H264, and they are based in Montreal. And this company does a lot. They work with shorts and features. They distribute films themselves in Canada. They're an aggregator to platforms. And then they also do what we call world sales. They work with new films and library titles. And Jean-Christophe was one of the founders of the company in 2015. Some of their recent sales titles include Gamma Rays and Humanist Vampire Seeking Consenting Suicidal Person, one of my favorite film titles in years. So I'm going to come to each of you, and I would love for you to tell us, of course, I just sort of read out your bios there and what your companies do, but tell us about one film you've worked on recently that you think maybe was one that did well, or also just really represents the sort of DNA of your company. So Alice, can I start with you about Lesange?
Well, in 2023, we've been lucky to win the Golden Bear at the Berlinale with On the Adamant, which is a documentary by Nicolas Philibert. Well, it's really part of Lesange DNA, actually, because we've been working with Nicolas for like 20 years, probably. We were selling To Be and To Have, which was a big, big hit, I think, 20 years ago. And On the Adamant is a very strong, excellent documentary. It's also the kind of documentary that is having a hard time on the market right now. Why it's a doc to start with. And it's really the kind of documentary that is meant for the theater. And it's a kind of documentary which is seeking the opposite of sensationalism. You know, it's a really nice, precise, tender documentary. It has nothing to do with what Netflix is producing at the moment, for instance. So we knew it could have been a hard sale, kind of. And then, I mean, the Berlinale took it in the official competition, which was very bold, because again, it's a doc and not all documentaries end up in generalist festivals on the red carpet. And from there, I mean, the press had been excellent, and then the Golden Bear obviously totally changed the course of things for the film. We sold it everywhere, and it's been released in over 40 territories so far. So it's really the kind of film that are part of what we do, and it was such a great experience.
That's really encouraging to hear, that a sort of art house documentary that needs to be, it's not about a celebrity, you know, it's not about Taylor Swift, but people want to see it. And you mentioned it's sold really well. Have all of those territories released it theatrically, or have some gone straight to streaming?
All territories released it theatrically, so we are very happy about that. Sometimes it was, I won't say small, but it was like medium releases, because obviously it's not easy to do a global release on a doc in some territories. And of course, afterwards, the film was sold to local TVs and to platforms. But I think that most of the time, for arthouse movies at least, the theatrical releases actually help a lot the digital career of a film, including when it's a doc. So it was really the two parts of a combination of the lives of the film abroad and in France.
Great. I want to talk about some more of that later. Karazina, can you tell us a little bit about something that's worked well for New Europe and represents what your company does well?
Oh, well, yes, of course. I feel like this year for us was a little bit of what it is for the film industry as such. So the worst expectations towards what's going to happen, and a lot of nice surprises as well. So I would say that the common phenomena that we are observing in the audiovisual market, like the polarization of the marketplace, the fragmentation of the marketplace and the audiences, is kind of translating into how our titles perform, either box office wise or market wise, in terms of either classical or like more multi-territory sales. For me, one of the biggest surprises was the title that you managed to mention, Housekeeping for Beginners, which is a tiny, tiny LGBTQ+ drama, a very heartwarming, well-told tale that premiered in Venice Horizonte that we managed to sell for Global to Focus Universal. But of course, this is also combined to a smart strategy and making sure that the filmmaker that was already having some films with them in the past is kind of well taken care for. And we managed to find the right position for the film and to fight to make it visible, even if it goes to this very corporate structure that is powerful, but also it has a certain, it kind of serves under a different role than the usual traditional art house distributors that we are working with. But like another title that I would love to mention is a title from the previous year that was launched in late 2022, box office wise. So like one of the first theatrical releases were France. It was the Uncertain Regard title Godland by Flynur Palmason, currently contending as one of the foreign best film Oscar contenders for Iceland. It's a Danish-Icelandic co-production with this kind of mixed team and talent behind the film. And what was really great for us was to see that we managed to see the development of the director from the very first film that we worked with, Winter Brothers, then A White, White Day, and now this one that not only got sold to multiple territories, including the Asian countries that usually proved difficult for us with this author, but it also proved to be well-liked by the audiences actually in the cinemas, because it performed really well at the French box office, at the Italian box office, the countries that were kind of shy on receiving so many titles that we expected to perform better. And it's a proof that if you're very consistent with building the brands of a film and a filmmaker, this is a tough filmmaking, a long film, a story with not that much plots behind it, a beautiful one, a masterpiece, but still something that is quite demanding towards the viewers. And still it manages to find the audience, which is, I think, one of the amazing surprises for us this year.
Great, thank you. And to mention, Housekeeping for Beginners is, I think, from North Macedonia. And for a film like that to sell to Focus Features is just a stunning result. And again, gives me hope for this industry that, you know, even the big companies are looking outside of the expected. It's not a horror film. You know, it's people are taking risks on just great films. So Jean-Christophe, or I'm going to call you JC, can you tell us a little bit about something H264 has been working on that you think represents what you do well?
Yes, I think one of the films that really embodies what we try to achieve and that kind of encapsulates our vision is Humanist Vampire, a seeking, consenting, suicidal person. I'll keep it to Humanist Vampire. You know, you mentioned it in the intro. We do a lot of things at H264. But the way the company grew over the years was very organic in the way we collaborated with the filmmakers. So, you know, we started working in shorts, then we moved on to digital, then we moved on to, you know, theatrical distribution, and then recently, you know, launched into international sales. And Human is Vampire is actually the very first film that embodies the vision that we have, where we're there to accompany filmmakers that have been doing shorts and are now doing, you know, their first features, which is the case for Human is Vampire. It's a film where we, you know, jumped on script, both for Canadian distribution, but for international sales as well. And it's a film that we launch in Venice and the Giornate degli Autori section, which won the Director's Award, then went on to TIFF, and which we release, you know, theatrically in Canada in October. And it was really for us a great way, and that was really the plan and the vision, was to try to, you know, build the brand of the film, making sure, you know, that the marketing campaign that we're doing internationally can kind of, you know, drop down to the local market and then build on that. And that's really what we try to do, is work on a limited amount of films and be there both in the festival circuit, international sales, and then bring that home to release it in Canada. And the film has done tremendously well, both in international sales and Canadian, you know, box office. So it was really like the very first project that really did that whole journey from script to finish. And it was really an amazing ride for us. Being new in international sales, we were doing international sales before, but mostly through aggregation. So it was kind of digital sales on an international scale. But yeah, the journey of Human is Vampire was really one that was really, really interesting and refreshing for us. Yeah.
Great. Thank you all so much. I think I understand each of the companies that really brought it to life a bit more. I wanted to ask you, as we are starting 2024, how healthy do you think the sales market is? Does it feel like we're back to pre-pandemic levels? And I don't mean just in terms of the number of deals you're signing, but I want to be rude and also mention the money. You know, are the deals worth as much? Are buyers paying as much for this, for a similar project? So yeah, could we talk a little bit about how healthy you see things are in terms of volume, in terms of deal level? Let's start with JC this time.
I think that's a really good question. We were not doing sales before the pandemic, so I cannot talk in terms of, you know, difference pre-pandemic, but we did start a couple of years ago with some specific projects. But what I can tell from what I'm seeing, you know, on the ground is that the market does seem much more healthier than it was like for the past couple of years. We see a lot of interest from important territories, but also territories that are usually known to be tough to sell, like, you know, a lot of territories in Asia and South America. So we were very lucky with the films we've had. Like we've had Red Rooms, Human as Vampire, and they sold really, really well. So I feel like the market is getting healthier, but I also see some sort of contradiction where it does seem healthier in terms of money and in terms of sales. But I feel there's a greater gap between some more established distribution companies that are more solid financially and more niche, you know, distribution companies that are well known and doing a great job, but are sometimes maybe a bit cautious in terms of risk that they're taking. So I do see a greater gap in terms of who's ready to put, you know, money on the table and who's willing to take some films, but at a smaller MG. And I do feel that tendency to grow in 2024 due to the economic context. So I'm still an optimist, but I feel it's getting better, but we might see a bump in the road in 2024. So that's my take on what I'm seeing thus far. Yeah.
I like that take. And also just mentioning that polarization of, you know, the really established people who've got money, they're secure, they could maybe take a bit more risk. And some of the really smaller distributors who may have been really hit during the pandemic and can't throw the cash around, you know, they never had much money, probably, and now they probably have to be very careful with it. Alice, how are you seeing the market?
Well, I totally agree with you when you talk of the polarization amongst the buyers. I would say another key thematic is really the polarization amongst the films. I would say I think a lot of sales companies had a very good 2023 year, including ourselves, for instance. But right now, you really need to have the right things at the right place. You know, the number of boxes you need to tick to actually do great sales is higher than ever, because if the film is a bit weak, or if it's a good film but you didn't manage to get the right selection, or if you are like not in the right narrative people are looking for, or if you are too political or not enough political, etc., 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 it can easily become very hard to sell a film. Having said that, when you do gather a lot of criteria that buyers are looking for, then it can get very good, or even crazy good, because somehow the buyers, I feel, are looking for a bit more safety than before the pandemic, because their local markets are harder than before. So I won't say they're all looking for the same films, but the focus is a bit narrowed on the same films. And then, well, the bidding wars can get very, very good in that case. Having said that, if you have a film that's neither a very big commercial movie or a very strong arthouse movie, for instance, if you are kind of in between, well, you have films that are doing no sales at all. And that's really tough, because those films that you would sell in between 4 to 10 territories in 2018, for instance, right now you can sell them nowhere, like absolutely nowhere. And it's really, really tough because they are not bad movies, you know.
Alice, I'm going to be unfair. Can I ask you, Alice, do you think there's too many films being produced? Are there too many films trying to be sold?
No, I don't think so. But I think that some of the films, I mean, the thing is, everybody started with a small budget movie. Everybody started with a first feature. One of the bestseller at Les Films de Losange is obviously Michael Haneke. Well, Michael Haneke's first movies didn't sell well, you know, and it was before the pandemic, way before, in a much healthier market. So I think everybody has to start with the films that maybe won't sell that well. You know what I mean? So we do need this diversity, and we do need those films that have flaws. The question is really how financially we can still go with them in a world where it is true that everything is a bit more polarized and people are looking for a bit more safety, probably. I don't believe there are too many films produced, no.
Okay.
But right now, to have a good year, you have to have some of your films in your lineup that are doing incredibly well. And it's still possible, but as I said, you really have to have a lot of boxes that tick to achieve that.
Great. Karuzina, are you seeing similar? Does it have to be the exact right mix of factors for buyers to be interested?
I'm not going to be a very political correct in some of my opinions that will follow, because I really like to observe and analyze the acquisition strategies of buyers. And sometimes they kind of try to emulate some kind of rational thinking, whereas they are still extremely irrational at core. I mean, they are still less irrational than they used to be before the pandemic, because everybody started to do the numbers, to compare the performance of the similar films in the marketplace before making an offer, consulting with their marketing films to check what the kind of potential they see in the film. So the whole decision-making process is much more lengthy one than we are were used to, and it's much more difficult to use the kind of emotional momentum that builds around the film if it's a buzzy title in a festival or marketplace. On the other hand, what was said before, I would only second that. So there are still those, like, because of the polarized market, there are still those few buzzy titles, and it's a little bit of a poker game with that. It's not that you can predict ticking the boxes. You happen to be ticking the boxes when you're becoming the it film. But it's not something you can really predict. And the buyers, the ones that can afford the risk-taking strategies, they're trying to reserve some space in their lineups for this kind of risky films that they can spend more on, hoping these are going to be breakers like Apple or After Sun, the films like that. And also to second what Alice have just said about too many films or not too many films being produced, I think we can discuss it as a case of like the cultural exception in the world of economy. So you have to start from somewhere. And to quote, it's like, just to give another example with the Anatomy of the Fall, it's like her previous films were not performing great. They were not received that well. And now we have a film that wins Palme d'Or and is performing super well at the box office around across Europe. So you also have to kind of invest in talents long term and in your relations long term, even if you cannot really afford to have all those films in your lineup. But then again, you have to kind of find balance between the ones that you want to over invest a little bit and take that risk if you can afford it, and the tiny, tiny films that maybe you will also squeeze in to follow the talent. But then again, there is this huge difference in the price range for the ones that are well desired by buyers in a certain market and the ones that are deemed as maybe superfluous or redundant, like, you know, it's like a nice shiny pair of shoes that you would like to have in your wardrobe, but maybe in the times of inflation, you cannot really afford them.
This has brought up some really interesting thoughts for me, hearing, you know, Alice talk about, you know, the early Haneke films probably didn't sell that well. And maybe people buy them as back catalog now. And I actually heard Katarzyna, your colleague, Jan Niewski, talking once about a small Croatian drama the company worked with called Quit Staring at My Plate. And he very openly said, you know, this is not a film we thought we were going to make money on. Really? Or, you know, maybe you'll break even with your involvement in it, but it wasn't going to sell for big numbers. It was more of a festival film. Maybe you'll get some festival screening fees. But I'm really curious about, yeah, this idea of when you might be able to work with a film that you know is not going to make anybody rich. But also, you all have companies. You know, these are companies. They're real businesses. So you have to keep an eye on that bottom line. You can't just do the sort of passion projects that aren't really going to sell. But, you know, how can you fit those in? And, you know, maybe I think some people don't even talk about this, but there are some films that sell, but maybe don't really sell for money. You know, I've heard about this with smaller independent films. They sell to a territory. The distributor says, yes, we're going to put it on this many screens. We promise we'll commit to this P&A, but we're not going to pay you 20 grand for the film. We're going to just put it out. But obviously that doesn't feed back in to a sales company's bottom line.
Yeah, but then again, as you well know, it's like part of our investment is investing in relations and talents and kind of growing them, only to be taken away by bigger companies at some point, in some of the cases, obviously. But then again, this is also a kind of investment on our side. We know we might lose money, or we know we will lose money on this one, hoping that the next film that the filmmaker will bring to us, because they know that we did good work, even if the results, like, it's also important for us then whenever we do that, it's less of a passion project in terms of something we fell in love with and we just like it, like the pair of shoes that I just mentioned. It's more like we believe that this is relevant work, the kind of film that we have in our hands, and this is a relevant voice that we want to bring to the world, and we want to associate this voice with our brands, because this will help us to also attract other filmmakers with maybe more commercial profiles when they see that even the small film is well cared for when we work with it. So this is like a combination of factors that helps us to build a network of contents and brands, which is bigger than those films themselves and the kind of direct economic value that they bring in.
Yeah, thank you for pointing all that out. And, you know, I do want to say every film salesperson I've ever met loves films. You're not just salespeople who would rather be selling, you know, real estate or printer toners because you could make more money doing that. But you care about films, and that's why you take these risks, I think. Alice, you were talking about, you know, when you do sort of, it's not necessarily ticking boxes for what buyers want, but when everything is sort of aligned. And it seems to me that shifts a lot from year to year. If you have a film that you're selling that's already shot and it's got Sandra Hüller in it, that's probably going to sell well because she's on a roll. But maybe in 5 years, Sandra Hüller's going to cool off a bit or not necessarily open a film. She's great. She probably will. But how do you try to predict when you come on board with a film what the market is actually going to want in a year or two? How can you do that? Alice, do you want to try?
Well, that's the hardest and probably most interesting part of our job, I guess, to try to understand what the audience wants in the end, and also how to not to sell, but how to promote a film, bringing to the, I mean, we're working mostly B2B, but ultimately we are all aiming at the B2C market, which is really the audience, either the theatrical audience or the digital audience. And the idea is really, how do we promote our films, showing a potential audience that they could actually like the film very much? So, it's very strategic, but it's also what's the most exciting and interesting part of our job. As you said, I wouldn't do real estate, for instance. I'm really a 100% passionate by films. And I think that it's interesting because, for instance, it's super hard in animation, because animated movies, you know, they take 4 to 5 years to be completed, to be totally produced. And it's really, really hard to tell whether within 4 years, 2D will still have a market at all, you know, or will 3D be, you know, not that much wanted anymore for some reason, how anime will have exploded, or will people be fed up by anime by then? So I think in the end, with fictions, you can still feel a bit where the wind is going. But with animation, it's super tough. It's super interesting. I love it, but it's super tough.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Jean-Christophe, I wanted to ask you a little bit, especially given H264's work as an aggregator. How, and for people who don't know, that means, you know, a producer wants to be on some nice platforms with their film, but the streamers don't have time to negotiate with each producer, so you might sell them a package of 40 amazing films, and then the producers are happy and the streamers are happy and you're happy. How are you seeing the streaming market right now? And I want to be clear that I don't, every time we say streamers, people just think Netflix, dum dum, you know. But I want to talk about all the streamers, because there's actually probably more business, more money with some of the local streamers, the not just Netflix and Amazon, right? Or JC, you tell me, what's the market like?
The market for, you know, VOD aggregation and streamers is really interesting. First thing off the bat, I would make the distinction between aggregation per se and working with streamers. And what I mean by that is the very concept of being an aggregator is being able to deliver content to platforms that need to work exclusively with aggregators, and that are mostly TVOD platforms like Google Play, like iTunes, because they have very strict, you know, quality controls, and they do not want to work with all distributors. So really, the very act of being an aggregator is working towards those big platforms, whereas the VOD market is being able to sell a film to like an SVOD platform, like a Mubi or a Netflix. And that, for that, you don't need to be an aggregator. So for us, we happen to do both, but for a traditional, you know, international sales company or even a production company, you can sell to like a VOD platform, but you cannot go directly to our transactional. With that being said, I would say that the market for streaming is very similar to the international sales per se, and that's why we became an international sale. We were already going to EFM to meet with streamers and to sell them content, so it was a very natural transition for us. But I would say that the biggest differences that we're seeing, the first one is the competition between big streamers is really affecting the indie market. You know, the production budget for originals is increasing as opposed to acquisition. At least in North America, we see a lot more of original production being put up front as opposed to acquisition. So it's very tough for indie films to get onto big platforms. And the second big difference that I'm seeing is the big difference between the US and Europe. Because in the US, streamers are so important, and the amount of money that they can give for a film is really substantially higher than in Canada or in Europe. So for US distributors to work with the streamers is really a tool to really build, you know, an effective, you know, release campaign. Whereas in Canada and Europe, streamers are part of a more natural chain of release where, you know, you do your festival, you do your theatrical, and then after 3 months, you're onto TVOD and then SVOD. So I think streamers play a larger role in the US than abroad. And that has strictly to do with the amount of money that's, you know, being offered. And you said, we always talk about the, you know, the same 5-6 big ones, but it's true. There are dozens of, you know, second tier platforms that are really interesting, you know, locally, and that give very decent MGs. And that's really, for us, one of the things that we're leveraging as an international sales company is that before we became a sales agent, we tried to look who are these second-tier platforms, but across the globe, and there are thousands. And for us, it's a way to balance our strategy of as an international sales agent, meaning that we will prioritize selling for theatrically outrights. But then when a film is maybe more festival-driven, are there some platforms we can target that we know on certain territories it might be a bit too risky to, you know, sell outrights for some distributors, but we can go directly to this platform to at least make sure the film is getting seen across the board. And that's why our model is like a two-headed dragon, where there's international sales and aggregation as a way to have some tougher films being distributed internationally on a larger scale. So yeah, it's really interesting, the contrast between territories, but also between the type of platform.
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about the US and Europe so far. I wanted to also ask just what international markets are exciting to all of you. I think I read an article with Helen Lee Kim from Lionsgate recently talking about that she was really excited about Vietnam growing. Obviously, people are talking about Saudi Arabia finally having cinemas and we can sell films to them. Where are there some emerging territories or just territories that you all see growing or putting a spark back into the market? Alice, are you keen on certain places?
It's not the territories I'm in charge of, but I think we're doing great, great deals with Southeast Asia and especially in Indonesia. I think Indonesia is a very, very exciting place at the moment. Some distributors are actually buying art house films and they are doing money with it. So that's super exciting for me. And it's obviously mostly digital, but not only. That's the opposite, you know, the opposite of how we were working 10 years ago. Now they buy digitals, right? And sometimes they take the theatrical rights with them. So I think it's really exciting. And I mean, it's a tough one, but for a special movie that hasn't been announced yet, so I can't talk much about it, but we are working intensively to see how films can be properly distributed in Africa. And it's actually very interesting because, I mean, there are not that many distributors on place, obviously, but a lot of people are thinking about it, are reflecting on it, mostly institutionals, but not only. And I believe, I hope, I want it to be the next audience for independent movies. Yeah,
those are both great examples. And Indonesia, I didn't realize until embarrassingly a few years ago how huge the population of Indonesia is. So this is a big market. And that's great to hear.
Yeah, huge and young.
Yes.
Huge and young. That's the key, I think.
We like that. Katarzyna, any territories that are popping out at you?
Not that many, I'm afraid. And when you mentioned Vietnam, this is something that is definitely exciting for the sellers that have a more commercial proposals or more genre proposals in their hands. So I know that also, for example, some of the Korean buyers are buying for the Vietnamese territory and they kind of try to join forces between the markets. This is something that is interesting, but we cannot really tap into that with the kind of lineup we have at hand, because these are mostly the kind of big 3D family entertainment animation or like straight on genre films that we are not working with. We like to have a few films always that have the genre appeal a little bit, but these are always still like first and foremost auteur dramas with a little bit of a genre touch rather than something that can be marketed directly at this kind of audiences in multiplexes commercially. But I can see that there are new buyers arriving and meeting with us, even if these are not exactly the buyers that will purchase something from us directly. So definitely that.
But also maybe in the future, you know, if they're getting used to seeing better and better commercial films, maybe in 10 years they'll be watching a great Icelandic period drama. Who knows?
I'm more curious generation-wise in terms of audiences, because I think I can observe, as like I also have like a 13-year-old daughter that the audiences are growing a little bit younger all across Europe. And this is not the standard silver hair audience that our buyers are used to be targeting that are in the cinemas right now for art house films. So I would love to observe that change a little bit more. I don't have the tools, but still with our intel and intuitions, because this is something I think as an emerging phenomenon across many European territories. Alice.
No, I totally agree with you, Kat, and I think that the answer is less a question of country, territory, it's more a question of generation. That's what I'm the most excited about. And to give a very old country to which we sell films in the US, I was so excited to see young people at the Lincoln Center wearing Mia Hansen Love's t-shirt. You know, and it's really funny because I believe in France, her audience tend to be a bit older, but in the US, she's really in. She's very a hit for a young audience. And that's what I think is the most exciting at the moment, more than the question of the countries, I believe.
Yeah, and I love that you said Lincoln Center because, you know, as an ex-New Yorker, I know that Lincoln Center audience used to be like 65 plus. To have young cinephiles in there cheering for Mia Hansen Love makes me excited as well.
I went with my daughter last week to see the Dream Scenario, and it was a full room. And more than half of the audience were like young boys who were like maybe 15, 16. And that was not something I would expect. I mean, so I would expect them to go and see like whatever else was playing in the cinema, which I don't really even remember what it was. But it was nice to see that kind of demographic change in the audiences. And normally you would see a completely different set of people in the room.
I love that somebody just said intel and intuition, I think. And that's something I really wanted to talk about. And if, you know, a lot of what makes a hit is based on gut feeling sometimes now. But, you know, with more data becoming available to everybody and with AI technologies, you know, are there ways that you think sales companies can use some of these new tools in the future, even if it's for comparison box office? I mean, that's something you already do. But is there a way an AI can help you do your jobs, for instance, or just better analysis of data? Is that something you're all thinking about? JC, can I ask you?
I think for us, it's really central to our approach. So for example, we are developing a software that we've been working on for the past 2 years, and we did present it at EFM Startup last year, which is a way to connect our software to all digital platforms with whom we're working, and gather data not only on the availabilities of the platforms, but also on the positioning of the films. So therefore, we're able to, you know, like a bookstore, to know, am I only at the back of the store in the A to Z section, or am I in the front shelf? Am I in the coup de cœur section? And that way, it's giving us information to build business intelligence, to work on positioning our film, but we also can gather the same data on similar films, on, you know, competitive films. So for us, it's very essential to be able to use these tools, whether, you know, that's one that we're, you know, developing internally, but there are also, you know, available tools to gather data and make our job easier. But, you know, we've been just talking about audiences and generation, and to be able to identify them, know where they are, what they're, you know, consuming, I think is going to be key in not only the projects that we're going to be selecting, but also is going to be key on, you know, the relationships we're going to build with distributors. So we can have that conversation with them about audience, you know, crafting, because if they know better their audience and we can work with them, you know, they're going to have success and we're going to have success. So I think, I don't know if it's AI, I think AI is a trendy word right now, but for us, it's data. I think we need to learn about data. You know, we're pouring thousands of dollars in marketing campaigns, you know, either as a sales agent, but mostly as distributors. And we're not collecting data from one campaign to another and trying to have like a mosaic of what are people going to see in certain cinemas. So I think being able to aggregate data from multiple campaigns and use these tools is really going to make a difference in the years to come.
Katarzyna, did you want to jump in on that?
I mean, it's like thinking about what Jean-Christophe is describing. It's our business model, the kind of companies that Alice and I work at is less B2C directed. So it's not this kind of data that we are looking to have. So for us, it's mostly using AI for like easy searches and qualitative comparisons and or benchmarking or whatever there is out there, which is available and verifiable, because we also don't want the AI to hallucinate on certain subjects. And so this is something that it's like we don't have, we are not tech savvy company that has the tools to develop our own add-ons or software ourselves, but we are definitely observing the market and the tools in place, because as you know, that this is also a problem that for example, if we were to analyze the data from the SVODs, it is not exactly available in a verifiable form, and there is no obligation to share this information. So we would be curious to analyze that. However, it's quite impossible to access this yet from the open source tools position, I would say.
Great. As we're looking at the future, I want to make sure we are looking ahead, because that's what this podcast really likes to do. And I think I'm not even going to ask you to look ahead 10 years, because maybe we'll all have, you know, robots implanted in our brains by then. But let's look ahead 2 years, 2026. Do you think your companies are going to be working in pretty much the same way they are now? Or do you see any major differences and changes in approach that will be coming to international sales? Jean-Christophe, it sounds like your company does the most different kinds of activity. How do you see your company evolving in those 2 years?
Well, for our company, it's kind of the opposite. Like, we finally arrived to a point where, like, this is what we've been striving for the past couple of years. So try to consolidate and really build on, you know, the quality of the catalog and build on that. So for us, we've come to arrive to a point where we like, you know, being able to distribute limited amount of films, build their momentum internationally, and then bring them domestically. But I think what will change in the next 2 years, of course, technology will have huge impact. You mentioned it. I think one thing that will change is, you know, VOD won't be the talk of the town anymore. You know, at one point, you know, it was the streamer war, and then it was like, oh, AVOD platform is the new thing, which I don't believe is true. So I think we'll find a more stabilized market in VOD, and that won't be much the talk of the town. I think one thing that will also change is we're going to see more and more companies joining forces, because revenue are being fragmented at the moment, and it's a tendency that's growing. So we're going to see, you know, different mergers in different landscape, for the better or the worse. We'll see. But yeah, I think that's what will change in the years to come, and emerging markets that will, you know, take bigger spaces, you know, to tackle quickly on that subject, which we talked a few minutes ago. I think Africa is a huge market, especially for French-speaking content, and India too. So I think that will be something new in the years to come.
Good predictions. I like those. Katarzyna, what are you thinking about in the near future might change?
I usually have very dark vision, so I'd rather not share. But on the other hand, what I kind of already am seeing when I'm talking with people is maybe not this kind of consolidation of mergers in this kind of hard economic sense, but I observe a lot of alliances and collaborations between different actors of the marketplace. So festivals with distributors teaming up with producers. There is much more dialogue, I think, between different players, and or there are like collaborations between cinemas, some initiatives that allow for a more sustainable approach to distribution, and not only meaning a more like green distribution strategies and such, which is something that became somewhat of an interest. It's like, I think we kind of self-indoctrinated ourselves through writing so many EU-funded proposals that eventually we we are kind of living that reality. We want to be improving world also into that direction. But it also means that people are, I think, trying to find a little more balanced way to work in the industry. And that means to manage expectations, to scale down sometimes, to be more flexible with the P&A spend and the way you structure your campaign, to be more creative and use different set of resources. I think here, again, like data-driven approach would be very much welcome. We can already see that distributors are much more used now to using services that allow them to analyze their target audiences better, to plan the media spends, not to go by this kind of default strategies that we're used to in the past, but experiment more and be more flexible with the change if they see this is something that is necessary for that particular campaign.
And Alice, yeah, what are you thinking that's coming up in the next few years? Is it hard to know?
I think in line with what we were discussing about what we could see exciting in the future, I think it has to do with the younger generation. I think we will manage to attract a younger audience worldwide for films, for the independent movies. I hope new companies, I hope new voices in the industry. Yeah, that's what I'm the most excited about. And on a very different note, I hope that in 2026, we won't be talking all the time of new sexual harassment cases. I hope it will be a bit behind us because, I mean, it's amazing what's happening and that everybody's talking about it, but it's also so depressing what we can see and witness. And I really hope that we will be in a healthier industry in 2026.
Great. I love the healthier prognosis, and I think you're right. I really want to thank Alice and Katarzyna and Jean-Christophe, and of course to Europa International to helping us develop this episode. There's been so much to talk about. I could go on for another few hours, but I don't think our listeners have that much time. But it's been really interesting to hear, and it's been more uplifting than I thought it might be, because it's a tough business. But to hear about, you know, art house documentaries selling around the world, to hear about, you know, a quite slow auteur drama from Iceland selling around the world, I think we are seeing some bright spots. To hear, you know, North Macedonian films being taken on by Focus Features, great. Some people are taking risks out there on the voices we want to hear from. So that's really great. It's just interesting to hear you also talking about the different levels and the sort of polarization from who's sort of got money and attention. And then it can be easy to, at the lower end, to maybe struggle a bit more, but hopefully still find a path to audience at the end of the day. And I really liked how bullish you all are about some new technologies helping us, new companies, new voices, some growing territories, and especially youth. Let's get those young people watching great independent films, and then we'll all be doing well. So thank you all for your insights and your passion.
Thank you, Wendy.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
This season of Industry Insights podcast is produced in cooperation with the Goethe Institute and co-funded by Creative Europe Media. And today's episode was developed in partnership with Europa International, the partner with Berlinale EFM on today's episode. So thank you for joining us. Please do tune in for future episodes. You can find these podcasts wherever you normally get your podcasts or on the website of the EFM, which is efm-berlinale.de. And a little plug for me that I host the EFM Morning Briefs podcast during the EFM in February. So if you want to know what is actually happening on the sales market on the ground during the EFM, tune into those and we'll make sure to let you know what's selling, how the market is healthy or not, and seeing if all these predictions come true. So thanks to everybody who spoke today, and thanks to everybody who listened. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye.